welcome to the 1 Year No Beer podcast. My name is Rory Fairbairns, and today I am your host. Today I am joined by Shah. Shah Wasmund has over 20 years' experience building and exiting multiple businesses. Shah was awarded the MBE from the Queen for service to business and entrepreneurship. She was also named one of the UK's top 20 most influential entrepreneurs by the Sunday Times and one of the most influential women in the UK by the Institute of Directors. You are going to love this podcast, so let's, without further ado, let's hear from Shah. Welcome to another fantastic episode of the 1 Year No Beer podcast. I am Rory, your host today, and I am joined by a very special guest who has been on the podcast before a long time ago. So I'm looking forward to catching up with you again fully. Today, I'm joined by Shah Wasmund, who over the last 20 years has a full experience of building and exiting multiple businesses. Shah has been awarded an MBE from the Queen for services to business and entrepreneurship. I am envious and hope that there's a day for me there. She was also named one of the UK's top 20 most influential entrepreneurs by the Sunday Times and one of the most influential women in the UK by the Institute of Directors. So welcome to the show, Shah.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited. I love talking to you and I love everything that you do at 1 Year No Beer. So yeah, I'm really excited about unpacking what's been going on and hopefully some snippets of conversations that will spark conversations in the listeners.
Yes, let's drop some inspirations. Would you want to give us a bit more? I mean, I've touched on some color there into your background. Yeah. But do you want to bring us up to a bit more speed about
I'll give you the whistle stop tour. So because it's probably quite relevant to start at the beginning, but I'm going to make it short. So I started my career in a very kind of very unusual way, working with Chris Eubank Sr., who was the then super middleweight champion of the world. I was the first and only at the time licensed female boxing manager. I just graduated from LSE with an economics degree and all my peers were going off to work in JP Morgan and Citibank and, you know, selling their soul to the devil. And I thought, I just can't be doing this. And so instead, I went into boxing and I absolutely loved it. I've been exceptionally unfortunate to be impacted and supported by phenomenal men. So I think that's really important in this conversation because I talk a lot about the work I do with women. I've just come back from running a retreat in Marrakesh for female entrepreneurs. But actually, you know, being pro-female, being a feminist doesn't make me anti-male whatsoever. And I always give full credit to the men who have really kind of along my career given me way more opportunities than maybe my CV would give me credit for at the time. And that started very much with Chris, but I was incredibly lucky that when he retired, I had a chance meeting with Sir James Dyson. And then I worked with James for 5 years from around a kitchen table to building up this billion-dollar brand. Then went to technology. I was one of the first women in the online space, back in the 90s. Set up one of the first internet travel companies with Sir Bob Geldof, exited one of my own companies to be Sky B, ran a technology fund with a tech kind of legend, Dan Wagner. And then I think, you know, after the 2008-2009 kind of banking crisis, I started to rethink what I really wanted to do. How could I give back? I had a young son. I feel like I'm doing a disservice to all the amazing people who supported me during this time. But I also went through a huge amount of tragedy where I lost my partner and my son was only 3.5. And so I kind of felt like I have a before and an after. So I have a before my partner died and an after my partner died. And so after he passed away, I reevaluated my career and I made decisions based on my priority, which was to be absolutely fully present for my son, to never miss anything at school, to take 17 weeks holiday, to do whatever it took to give him the stability that, one, I never had as a kid, but two, that I felt had been taken away from him by not having his dad. And so it's weird because the outside world would think that maybe, you know, the last 10-12 years have been super productive for me, but actually I feel like I've very much been on if you're going back to a car, like old school cars, because we're both old enough to have been able to drive a manual, I feel like I've been in sex torture. They do indeed, especially overseas. And I feel like I've been in second or third gear. Mm. And that's because my priorities shifted. And I think quite rightly so. And that's not that I wasn't interested in business anymore, but I had to create a business that gave me way more flexibility than I had previously.
Yeah.
And now...
Stop being a slave to it.
Yeah, exactly. But now we've come full circle. So now my son is 17. He's in his first year of sixth form. And suddenly my world is doing literally a full circle. I've suddenly started reconnecting with people that I worked with 10 years ago. So Dan Wagner, who I used to run a tech fund with, to James Dice. And like, it's bizarre. Chris Eubank, I said to you before we started recording, Chris came and stayed with me for 10 days over Christmas. I mean, it was batshit crazy and at the same time. And so I feel like, much like a book, our lives and our businesses go through chapters. And I feel like I'm very much about to embark on a whole new chapter.
Exciting.
I'm very excited too. I am really excited.
Hopefully you can tell us a little bit more about that. But it does. I mean, life does go in chapters. And it goes through these times of ups and downs, and then all of those learnings from the pain before come into the future and everything else. Definitely talking from experience there.
I think it's hard, really, to when you're in it. I hated people saying this to me. So when I was in a really shit period of my life, I hate people saying to me, time's a healer. And I'm just like, fuck off. Or, you know, things will get better. I'm like, how the fuck do you know? Or when they're telling you that, you know, or somebody came to me and said, don't worry, Shaw, life is like a book. You're just in this chapter right now. There'll be a new chapter coming along anytime soon. I didn't want to hear any of that shit, I'll be honest.
No, so I know that nobody does.
No.
Well.
But it's true. It's true. Nothing good lasts forever and nothing bad lasts forever. And I think we just have to hold on to those things and keep moving forwards.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, 100%. I mean, if I look at my own entrepreneurial journey, which, yeah, this is the sixth business. I didn't exit businesses and sell them like you did, though. So I was clearly missing something. You know, and even in this journey of 1 year no beer, you know, this has been one hell of a journey. I would say the chapter, last year really changed when we pivoted the entire business really to focus into a new area, and now we're seeing fantastic growth again, and it's transforming everything. It's very exciting to have that solid foundation. I don't know why we had to go through all the pain, before. I don't know why it had to be so painful for so many years.
It's stubborn, partly, really.
It does.
We're stubborn, and I think we're hard-headed. And sometimes, as much as we can work with mentors and other people, sometimes we just have to learn the lessons for ourselves to believe them.
Yeah. Have you ever read Ben Horowitz's The Struggle?
I have.
Yeah, exactly. So that's it. I just read that out and I'm like, okay, so I'm not the only one. It's like, even when everything is dark, no one talks to you, you run out of money, you don't know what you're going to do, you're in absolute suffering, you can't get out of bed, your body aches, your mind is painful, yet this is just the part of it. This is the struggle.
It is. And the struggle allows you to have empathy with other people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely it does. Tell me through all of this piece here, you know, you've been really focused now for a while on helping other people build their businesses and build their businesses up. What about your past experiences? I mean, it's obvious from people who you've worked with. I mean, you know, being a part of that Dyson story as an example, you know, I imagine just infatuated with brand, infatuated with high quality, infatuated with, you know, shipping product. I don't know yet. What was some of the things that you've learned through these journeys?
You're spot on, Rory. Infatuated is a great word. Obsessed is another one. Yeah. Obsessed with branding. Yeah. Obsessed with the little details. Like, I've already noticed you've got your Aura ring on. Like, yeah. my eye, I catch everything. And I learned that from James. And so when you look at any of our materials, whether it's our books or our programs or my website or anything, I'm obsessed with the branding details. And one of the things I learned working with James was, we went out at Dyson from day one with a brand that looked like we were the market leader. So we didn't come into the market looking like we'd just come into the market. Mm. We came into the market looking like we owned.
We owned it.
Right?
From the get-go. That sounds like you, Shah.
No, never.
It sounds like when you walk into the room. Yeah.
Well, I learned all of that. To be fair, I learned that initially from working with Chris Eubank. You know, you would walk into a room with Chris and, I mean,
he owns the room.
He owns the room, but he also owns his brand.
Mm.
So there's a lot of similarities. People think, how did you go from boxing to vacuum cleaners?
Yep.
It seems crazy, but actually there are very strong ties between the two. Chris was an absolute maverick eccentric. So is James. Chris absolutely understood the value of building his own brand, as did James. Chris was absolutely obsessed about the detail, as was James. Chris was absolutely gave zero fucks what anybody else thought, as does James. There's a lot of similarities between the two. They were just operating in different marketplaces.
Yeah, amazing. And Steve Jobs talks about that. He says, you know, looking forward, it's very hard to see the path. But then looking back, you always see how the dots. Exactly. Yeah. Join the dots of going onto this path. What do you think some of the key things for people about setting up a business? You know, what are you regularly advising people on, and what are the similar things you're coming up on?
Okay, so this might be different advice than I would have given previously, because I, like I said, I feel like I'm going into a new chapter, which is also bringing back a whole load of my previous chapter. And so I think that what I would say today is that you're all playing too small. Ruri, why have you not exited a business? Like, let me show you how to exit a business. Why are the people who are listening thinking to themselves that it's going to be good enough if we get to six figures? Fuck that. If you're going to put the work in, this is the bit, and I know that you know this, Ruri. If you're going to put the work in, let's take all the reward, not just a tiny part of it, because I'll tell you the truth. And Ruri, if you think I'm wrong, I am all up for you shooting me down. But I truly believe that it takes just as much effort to build a business that's going to make you six figures a year than it does to build a business that's going to make eight figures a year. And the reason is that the scale is just turning dials as long as you've got the business set up in the right place. And it's about our level of ambition. And I feel like, especially for women, I want to, you know, I actually, ironically, most of my one-to-one work is with men and most of my group work is with women. Although I'm literally in the process of setting up a new mastermind, which is either going to be mixed or just for men based on my one-to-one clients. And I say this because people often think that I only work with women, which is just completely not true. But what I do see is there are differences between men and women.
Yeah.
And I think there is this turning, I call it the rise of the female entrepreneur. And what that means is it's a woman who's running a business where she doesn't just want to be a coach. She actually wants to be an entrepreneur. She wants to build a business, and she wants to build a business that she can exit. And I want to talk about what an exit means, because I want people to really, I want to demystify it. Exit does not necessarily mean that you sell to Procter & Gamble, or you sell to Dyson, or you sell to some of these big, huge companies. Exit could mean that, but it could mean you sell to a competitor. It could mean you sell to your management team, you do a management buyout. But it could also mean, an exit could also mean that you build a business that allows you to remove yourself from the day-to-day running of the business and allow a general manager and a team to run the business for you without you having any day-to-day involvement, but you still reap the rewards of all your hard work financially by still taking a salary, by still taking dividends, by still contributing to your pension. And I think we need to have this conversation more, because I think I see too many people, men and women, putting so much time and effort into building their business without any clear idea on how they're going to exit this business.
Completely, totally.
I'm a little bit.
If you floated that idea to my team about removing me from the business, I think they'd all vote for it. So, Ruri, out of the day, yeah. You know, it's what. Fantastic what you said then. It brought into mind a couple of things. You said you spent Christmas with Chris Eubank. I actually spent Christmas with Grant Cardone. And I don't mean in person, obviously. Not yet, anyway. But I did listen to 10X Mentor, and I listened to it on repeat. So I had a four-day drive from Mallorca back up to Mull to bring the dog for Christmas. Most ridiculous thing I've ever done. But I spent that with him on repeat. And listening to that 10X was just like, in a way, in the business, because we've been so focused on fixing, the view had come down to just our trainers, basically. You know, am I trainers tied and where am I looking? And getting back into this, I was like, no, you've got to remember what I'm trying to do here and get back into that vision piece and look at it. Normally, right, I have no problem with vision. I've always been, always been brought down. You know, growing up on the Isle of Mull, right, the people around me, the ambition is probably to be in fishing or forestry, right, and you know, maybe tourism. And so always my ambition and my dreams were being knocked down by people or were being judged or laughed at, but it never stopped me, right? It never stopped me having that enormous vision. It's no different today. So I pitched to an angel investor and they're like, yeah, you're never going to IPO a billion. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous or whatever you might be communicating to somebody. And I'm like, no, just you have to ignore the people who think that they're grounded in normality, because we're not trying to be normal here. We're trying to be different.
No, you're trying to be different. You're trying to break the mold. But it's interesting what you said. I think that we go through phases. So I think that historically, I've always, similar to you, had challenges or problems with people around me who think that my vision's too big, that I want too much. Why can't I just be happy? Why can't you just settle? But then, again, like I'm saying, like you have chapters. I think then we get into this chapter where we're so in the weeds of the business that we lose sight of the vision because we just can't even see the daylight because we're just down here in the weeds trying to fix all the shit, trying to pull the fires out, trying to juggle all the balls, making sure they don't fall and smash somebody. You know. And then we're like, hold up a second, what am I doing this for? Where's my vision gone? And so it's so important to be able to regularly check in. Why am I doing this? Like, what is it I actually want? Who do I want to be? How do I want to show up? Who do I want to serve? How do I want to serve them? And what is in this for me? Like, what is my long-term goal for doing this? And that's not always just about money. It's very, very rarely just about money.
Exactly.
It's a bigger vision. And typically, if you can actually execute on that bigger vision, the money follows. But what stops most people from executing on the bigger vision is being caught in the weeds and not being able to get out.
Completely. Thinking of current availability tools and skills thinking. You know, talking to a guy last week and he's like, oh, you know, we put businesses together and take them to public equity and blah, blah, blah. And we find out the missing pieces and bought them, all this kind of chat. And it is like, okay, well, so the realms of a possibility when somebody starts their business, they're just literally thinking, well, how do I get a customer? And it's so in that little thing there, rather than thinking in the much, much higher level thinking. I think this leads us beautifully onto the importance in a business of having a coach or having a mentor or having coaching. And of course, that is what you do a lot of, coaching and mentorship. Tell me a bit more about that, about how you approach
it. Yeah, and also I think how it's definitely evolved hugely over the last 18 months. So I think that I probably spent a good few years really focused on coaching and mentoring coaches on how to grow their coaching practices and their businesses. And I think that I really missed being able to work with high-level entrepreneurs. And there's a difference between a coach and an entrepreneur. Yeah. And that's not to say that coaches can't be entrepreneurs, but the vast majority of coaches don't want to be entrepreneurs, and that's completely fine. But we also have to be honest with ourselves and not feel like we're too big for our boots by saying things like, I'll be honest, I prefer working with entrepreneurs. I prefer working with cross-discipline entrepreneurs from multiple sectors because my network, my contact base, my experience spreads multiple disciplines and sectors. I don't want to just be in this kind of like echo chamber where everybody's having the same conversation.
Yeah.
So for me, the work that I really love to do is working with male and female entrepreneurs who really want to scale their business and exit. And like I said, exits aren't something that is only for a privileged few. Exits could be relevant for almost everyone. And it goes from everything from just removing yourself from the day-to-day running of the business and having somebody else in the business running it for you, to selling to a competitor, to selling to a private equity, to selling to a VC potentially even, to merging with other companies, to absolutely listing on the stock market. I sit on the board of two big fintech companies. And I'm loving, no matter how volatile the markets is, those big people conversations, you know, like when you shift your conversations, you start to realize how small you've been thinking. So in one world, everybody's in this race to get to seven figures. In this world, they're like, We're listing in 6 weeks for 2 billion. And then post that, this is our goals over the next 3 years. And how are we going to get to a 5 billion within 3 years? And what acquisitions do we need to make? And, you know, we're going to put aside this amount of money to go out and make acquisitions. Charles, what do you think we should be looking at? It's a whole, and you wouldn't know that was possible. We can't be what we can't see.
Yeah.
So I just want more people to understand what's possible. It doesn't mean you need to want all of it, but just really understand that this landscape is available to all of us, no matter what gender, no matter what race, no matter what socioeconomic background you come from. And I think the more we can change those dynamics, the more we can change the narrative around what running a business should not just be about making ends meet and a little bit more. Running a business should be about creating a legacy, should be about creating generational wealth. It should be about leaving an impact. And honestly, it should be about exiting so that you reap the rewards of all the hard work that you've put in over not just the years that you put into this business, Ruri, but all the years you put into the previous businesses that you brought with you to this business.
Yeah. Just as a tiny little side note, there was a Scottish Tech Founders Chat, and we were talking recently about, you know, a remuneration when you're funded or whatever is going to be squeezed. It's you know, if to come through hard times, your investors are going to expect you not to take salary. I've done a period of months. I mean, when I first started, it was 4 years of no salary when I first started 1 year no beer. And then, you know, I've done periods where I've had to swallow salary or not taken any salary because it's been a very, very difficult time in the business. And I was talking to a lady recently, and she's 12 years into building her business, which really helps people. It's in medical health. It's helped a lot of people. You know, it's changed lives. And yet that salary has been squashed the whole time. And there are loans, and there's loans against the house and everything else. And she's now folding the business. And it's been, I don't know, 12 years of running this thing. And it's just taken so much. And you think about all the stress.
Okay. Can we address this?
Yeah.
I want to address this. I want to address this to anybody who's listening to this. One, never, ever, ever, ever don't take any salary.
Yeah.
Number two, pay yourself first. Number three, never let anybody who's investing into your business tell you that you can't take any money out. And I'm going to tell you why. One, it is your blood, sweat, and tears that is building this business. Two, if you are stressed about how you pay your rent, how you pay your mortgage, how you pay the gas bills, or you're just stressed that you haven't had a break or a holiday for 18 months, let me tell you something. Whoever puts money into their people will not get a return on their investment if you are stressed to breaking point. It is nonsensical. I've heard this argument from VCs before, and my response has been, how does that logically make sense? So let me give it to you. Pretend you're the VC. So I'm going to tell you, you have to work for the next 6 months and you have no income. So I don't know how you're paying your school fees. I don't even know how you're paying your mortgage. And I certainly don't know how you're going to the Maldives. But actually, I don't even know how you're going to Malaga, mate, because you've got nothing for 6 months. Now tell me how great your work's going to be for 6 months.
Yep.
It's going to be piss poor because all you're doing is being stressed about money. How does that serve the business?
Yeah.
And how does that serve the investor?
I need you on my board, Sean. Sean for the board.
I'm pretty formidable on a board. Tell me. I'm like, I come at it with statistics and facts. And when you turn it on someone, they think, you see, they recognize, shit, she's right, but I can't say she's right because then that means I'm wrong. So I'm just going to have to try to style it. And I can accept that sometimes you might have to take a pay cut. I get that. And I think that's fine. But way too often, people aren't even paying themselves for years.
Mm, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's crazy.
The stress that puts on you and on your family is untenable.
Yes. So you were talking there. We were talking a lot about stress. So putting that into perspective, you mentioned about the Oura Ring. So Oura Ring I've worn for 7 odd years, but in our complete control program that we put business owners and senior execs through this program now, we use the Oura Ring to track them, right? So we're monitoring them every single day. And if they don't, you know, if sleep is poor, exercise isn't being done, meditating, they get text messages for accountability and we literally phone them, right? So we're being really, really, it's like coming away from an intervention, but doing it whilst you're at work or running your business. This, you know, what we ultimately saw is, or the science is all there, is that stress is just such a massive contributor to compulsive behavior. So high levels of stress and not having the tools to mitigate that stress, you're always going to want to numb out. And so this is why we're trying to address this for people, is to not only, okay, we can reduce stress because alcohol, you know, inhibits a lot of stress, but also we can help them consume, sort of mitigate a lot more stress by changing the way they do things, meditating, exercise, all that kind of stuff. So, how you know, the stress element is so huge, especially for people who run businesses. You know, we've got other people's paychecks to worry about and things like that. So, yeah, how much do you see stress coming up for people? And, you know, what do you do to recommend to people to change that stress?
All right, let's unpack this a little bit. So firstly, the statistics show that entrepreneurs have the highest stress levels of anyone in the workplace. They also have the highest levels of depression and suicidal thoughts. Yeah. And this is frightening, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed, and I think it can be addressed. I think that there's also, I don't know whether entrepreneurs have a higher propensity for being ADD or ADHD, or people with ADD and ADHD have a higher propensity for wanting to be entrepreneurs. So they probably kind of fit together. So if you put all of that together, what happens is you have the recipe for a bonfire. So how do we keep that under control? One, I accepted very early that I've got an addictive personality. I grew up with a narcotics, abuser. My dad didn't really drink, but he consumed a copious amount of cocaine. And I grew up in a very abusive domestic violence family situation as a result of that. And so I think I recognized very early on that I had a choice to make. And my choice was that I have never smoked, I've never drank, and I've never done any drugs my entire life, ever.
Wow.
And I think that is a recognition subconsciously from a very young age that I knew that I had an addictive personality, because I'm binary. I'm all in or I'm all out. I'm either going to go to bat for you every single time without thinking about it, or I would rather just not be in your world, because I don't really do the small talk, and I don't really do. So knowing that about yourself, being self-aware, I think that's really important. I think to manage your stress, you've got to be self-aware to know where are your trigger points. And so for me, and this can also be an addiction, so I try to manage it. I have to go to the gym every day. Like I will frequently go 6 days a week.
Mm.
And even if on one or two of those days, I would do maybe, you know, a slightly easier workout, but it's the consistency and it's the habit.
Well done.
Those two things are key.
Yeah.
Consistency and habit.
Well, I struggle with the consistency one, because being ADHD is that there's nothing consistent about me. Apart from my inconsistency, and being consistent is very, very, very difficult. So I have to allow myself to not be consistent. But also, I remember, I've talked about this many times in this podcast, but my coach, he was like, well, you are consistent at one thing. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, you're consistently persistent. That's now my branding. He sent me a AirPod Pros with consistently persistent. He's like, you're like, can we change it to consistently relentlessly persistent?
they wouldn't all fit in on the box.
Exactly.
So I think to manage stress, I think one, you have to be very self-aware, because how I manage stress isn't necessarily the way that would be right for other people. But I think that being honest with yourself and who you are, if you know that your way of managing stress is to overeat or is to drink or is to do drugs, then you have to find other alternatives that are going to give you some kind of outlet. So the stress has to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I work out, I go for a walk, I listen to, you know, I listen to music, and a particular type of music that puts me in a particular head state, right? You have to change your state of mind. And sometimes to change your state of mind, music can do it, but sometimes you have to physically change your state. Like you have to move yourself out of where you're sitting.
Totally.
Go somewhere else, do something else.
So Tony Robbins quote, the fastest way to change your mental state is to change your physical state.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. I don't necessarily believe everything that guy says, but I believe that one.
He says a lot.
He says an awful lot. And I feel grateful that one of the upsides, if you've been able to survive a really dysfunctional childhood, one of the upsides is you're super resilient and you know that you can deal with a lot, maybe a lot more than you actually should. But it means, for me at least, I manage stress very well.
Yeah.
I really don't get stressed. If I get stressed, everybody knows there's some big fucking problems on the table. Because I was stressed. Because I'm usually like, don't worry about it. It's going to figure itself out. Don't worry about it. No big deal. We've been here before. It's all going to be fine.
Yeah, it is funny. It is funny to be in that role. You know, literally the building is burning behind you. It's all on fire. And you're just like, it's okay, everyone. Don't worry. Everything's fine. Yeah.
That's been there before.
Exactly. Exactly. So we have had the 10-year anniversary for your outstanding book. And you have now relaunched it. It's called Stop Talking, Start Doing. Is it?
It is. Stop Talking, Start Doing, the 10th anniversary edition.
Awesome.
This book genuinely, again, changed my life. I feel very fortunate that I've had like these pivotal moments where something happened and my whole career changed. I took on a new direction. And the first version of this book came out 10 years ago. Sir James Dyson wrote the foreword. Seth Godin wrote the front cover blurb. So we punched way over, you know, way above our weight on this book. But we sold hundreds of thousands of copies all around the world. And I think the reason is, it's a perennial favorite, procrastination. Mm. I mean, the book addresses the topics of procrastination, and it's done in a really like simple, oh, this is one of my favorite. Can you see that? I love that.
Nice.
Right? Fear and regret. So, you know, regret weighs more than fear, but fear in the moment appears bigger. And yet we look back at our lives and we regret the things that we didn't do, all the chances that we didn't take. But in the moment, fear stops us from doing things. And so this book for me is just a perennial favorite, because we all procrastinate. We all have things that we want to stop talking and start doing. And for so many of us, those things are on a to-do list and they stay there for 5 years. And maybe they never actually come off the to-do list. They just stay there. And so really the book was written for myself and for anyone else who's got something, an itch, something they want to do, whether that's climbing Kilimanjaro or starting a business or moving to the south of France or getting married or getting divorced. I think we all have things that we want to do, and we just often need to find that little bit of gumption to get ourselves started.
We have a phrase in our family. So I've got two little girls, absolutely all the gung-ho I have, which is amazing, and more gumption. And that whenever they're standing on the edge or they're fearful or anything else like that, I just shout, "What's on the opposite side of fear?" And they go, "Fun!" and jump. And they say to it each other and everything else. It's just like whenever you feel the fear. But then I've got this sort of a lie in bed, and Jen's like, "Do you ever worry one time that they're actually going to have rational fear for doing something they really shouldn't, which is going to injure them?" And they just go, and dive straight into it. Hopefully we teach them also to have a little bit of common sense.
And contacts, right? If the gap looks too big to jump, let's build a bridge first.
Yes. Yeah, rather than later. So touching back into the no boosting for a little bit, the whole way through your very successful career, you have not been drinking, not been involved in drugs. So you've been a part of a lot of socializing and wining and dining and all of that kind of stuff. Have you ever felt like a disadvantage? Have you ever felt like you were disadvantaged because you weren't drinking? And how, you know, maybe one other is, has anyone ever said anything absolutely ridiculous to you other than, "Oh, are you pregnant?" Which I'm sure you've heard times before when you say you're not drinking or whatever. But yeah.
Interesting question. So no, I have absolutely never felt disadvantaged. If anything, I think you have an advantage, because I think that when you go out and you're sober, you remember everything, and the people, depending on how much they've drunk, may have a sketchy memory and you don't. So I've never ever felt at a disadvantage. I've also never felt uncomfortable. So I've never felt peer pressure. I do think, again, I'm going to give him all the credit he deserves. I think that because I started my career working with Chris, I just grew like balls of steel with spikes on. Like, I just don't, it's almost impossible for anybody to intimidate me. So if anybody was trying to intimidate me because I wasn't drinking, I just think that people just don't even try. I think that maybe I just carry myself in a way that it's just not a conversation. So just don't even bother going there, because you're going to come off worse from the conversation and you're going to look like a dick. So how about we just don't start the conversation? Because I have seen people, and it's weird that it hasn't happened to me, but I have seen people really almost buckle under peer pressure that...
Totally.
Why are you not drinking? Why are you so boring? That's the one. Like, why are you so boring? Why are you not drinking?
This is exactly why I asked the question, okay? Because only a drinker would ask the question, have you ever been at a disadvantage? Because the person who's never drunk before is like, no, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, why would I be disadvantaged? But the thing is, this is the perception, right? So yeah. The perception of people always coming into the programs is, oh, I don't really want to stop. And I don't think I can stop. And I don't think, you know, I don't want to be a non-drinker and everything else. And all of that is created by the drinking
stuff. It's just stories in your mind, Rory. And I think in my entire career, of all the times that I've been out to so many socials, I can't even remember, somebody only said that to me once. And my response in typical Shaft style was, because I don't need to drink to be interesting.
Yeah.
And that was it. They just ended up looking like they're telling me that I'm boring because I'm not drinking. So why are you not drinking? Because I don't need to drink to be interesting. But also fundamentally, because I don't want to.
Yeah. Mine's a bit less classy than that. Because I don't need to drink to be a dick.
True. True story. And also, no is a full sentence, right? No is a full sentence. And so because is also a full sentence. Why are you not drinking? Because. And it is not my responsibility or any of your listeners' responsibility to justify themselves to anyone else about why they're not drinking.
Yeah. Really interesting. I actually flicked onto a behavior change. They were doing a piece of study about that word because and how significant it is in the success of, in this case, it was cutting into line. And that when you use the word because, it's like 100% more likely for you to be successful and for those people to not feel resentment. And that's the thing, when you have a really strong lined up reason or whatever that they can understand, right? Because whenever you go, oh, well, I'm sort of not drinking, you are fodder for the sharks there, right? Because they'll prey on that thing. And that's why you get a good, strong statement to say, you nail it on the head and it's gone and disappeared and everybody moves on. Pretty much everyone, I would say, you know, now over 100 business owners who've been through our high-level program, I would say that pretty much every single one of them is shocked at the end by how little they actually want to drink once they've really gone through that process of understanding it all and seeing it from like that. And they get around to the other side and they're just like, I just don't want that at all back into how I'm operating. It's a much better place for it to come from when you're not using willpower. Oh, I have to not drink. I have to not drink because if I do, I'm fucked, right?
Yeah.
Or I go down a rabbit hole versus, no, actually, I'm consciously choosing.
I'm being intentional. I'm choosing. I think a great line would be, because I'm training for an Ironman. What are you doing,
exactly.
Fat snob?
That's pretty much so. How the program, day two, book a challenge. Day three, tell them that I'm 90 days not drinking, I'm doing the exactly Ironman. You're just so on brand, Shah. Tell you, Shah for the board. Except we haven't got any money, Shah, so you have to do it out of the goodness of your heart. Right, anyway, that was the pitch.
that was Rory's pitch.
Pitch her live on the podcast. Right there. It hasn't changed in all these years as well. I just sound the same. Amazing. Shah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How do people find out more about you and everything you're up to, apart from obviously go and get the book, Stop Talking, Start Doing, 10-year anniversary, hundreds of thousands of copies sold. There must be a reason. If you're procrastinating, go and get that book now. Where else can they find more of you, Shah?
Go to Amazon to buy the book and go to social media to find me. Easy to find because with a name like Shah Wasmond, just type in my name, I'll come up. And probably the best destination is just go to shaa.com. I bought that domain name 10 years ago and it's worth every single penny. So just go to myname.com.
What did you pay for it?
I can't tell you.
Come on. $10 million.
I did not pay $10 million. No, I paid $10,000. And I think about it like this. I think that people would pay that for a private license plate, which, you know, is probably not going to really earn them any money. But it's my whole business. My whole everything is built on it. So,
yeah. Fairbairns.com. Damn, I should have checked it out. Somebody's already done. It's just, I mean, you have to spell Fairbairns and it's lost then. Sha.com is easy. I guess you have to say double A, right? Oh, do you have to say that to people?
If you Google it, the only other thing you'll come up with is an Indian Shadi.com, and Shadi, because it's Shaadi.com, mm-hmm. is an Indian matchmaking service. So just so we don't get confused,
that's cool.
I am not that one.
Yes, not brilliant. Thank you so much for coming again on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Sha.